When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's News Dates and Podcast,
we talk about Boris Johnson and the extra money for the NHS, or not.
Helen gets very angry.
I do get very angry, very, very angry, repeatedly. And on You Ask Us,
has the BBC gone soft on the Brexiteers? So, shall we talk about everyone's favourite foreign secretary?
Who is that? Remind me who that is again.
It's also everyone's least favourite foreign secretary, captain, leader, legend, Boris Johnson, and his wizard wheeze to fix the NHS.
So remind me of the chronology of this story then. Basically, they were going to have a cabinet meeting on what, Monday morning?
Tuesday morning.
And ahead of the cabinet meeting, he decided, or friends of his, decided to brief out that he was bloody well going to ask for some more money for the old bally old NHS. How's that all going? On the basis that he'd made a big promise during the referendum and he was cribbins if he wasn't going to keep it. Yes?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, he'd made these remarks at a lobby drinks event fairly recently as well. The Neo-Leavers needed to start making the case for Brexit. It obviously was well leaked, including to papers who weren't, you know, in his supporters club, as it were, but obviously received a very glowing write-up from his supporters club, aka The Telegraph. Then this morning, from our perspective, and not this morning, from the perspective of whenever our listeners are listening to this, the papers were full of his kind of dressing down in cabinet, which, you know, kind of, as you would expect, sort of leaked incredibly quickly from various sources, where basically, you know, all of the Remain backing ministers were just like, this isn't helpful, this just helps Jeremy Corbyn, what are you doing? And then most of the Leave backing ministers were like, look, I agree we should put more money in the NHS, but like, let's not do it by, you know, it appearing in every paper that we think there's a crisis in the healthcare system. I think the most interesting and unreported part of what happened in the cabinet, I mean, it was reported because it has been well leaked to lots of people, including me. But the thing that I think lots of people hadn't really picked up on is that Jeremy Hunt also did the I really wish you hadn't done this by going to the papers. But he also said, but I agree that the NHS needs more money.
But don't you think this is another example of what I think we previously called the kind of prisoner's dilemma theory of the Tory party, right? Which is that it is in everyone's interests to stake out their leadership bid, although that is unhelpful overall to the concept of getting a Tory government re-elected.
Yeah, although actually in this case, I think weirdly, yeah, the thing that's always important to remember is that if you want most people to hear your message, you just need to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. Now, obviously, the effective way to do that is to have something like the long-term economic plan or Labour's message in 2017, where you can repeat it without necessarily appearing to repeat it. So Labour's big message in the, yeah, from basically the Easter recess onto the 2017 election was Labour will take something from the rich, i.e. not you, even if you were in fact someone who in kind of a distributional perspective should really define yourself as rich, and give something to everyone. And that was basically the golden thread of all of their policy announcements, and obviously it fit with their slogan. But it basically kind of meant that even if most people couldn't name, and basically the only Labour policies people could name in vast numbers by the election were the bank holidays and some of the animal rights stuff, actually, I think, yeah. And then, like, more money for the NHS, but there's always the suspicion that when you ask people to name a Labour policy and they go more money for the NHS, they're just probably this is a safe bet. But, you know, crucially, the Conservatives need to, if they're to have any chance at the next election of getting their majority back or staying in office in any way, shape or form, not beat Labour on the NHS. That will always be an away fixture for them. But just not have it be a high salience issue, which means two things. One, it means just putting more money into it. And two, it means talking a bit, ideally not during the general election campaign when they just do not want to talk about the NHS at all. But at this point, talking a lot about how, well, we know that there have been problems.
We're taking tough decisions.
We're taking tough decisions.
We're taking a long-term view. Yeah, I agree.
Here's some more money for it. Yeah, and then just like...
Do you think that immigration will be a big issue at the next election? I mean, I guess so much of it is dependent on when that is. But if you assume it is a post-Brexit next general election... Because it really went down in salience at this last election, which I think helped Labour enormously, as did obviously Labour's kind of slightly two-faced position on it in terms of ending freedom of movement while also saying cuddle refugees.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, right? And because the slightly odd thing about voter behaviour after the 2016 election is it both makes a great deal of sense and no sense at all, right? Then effectively, a large chunk of people who were concerned about immigration up until the 2016 referendum regard that issue as fixed because they voted to leave the EU. Now, of course, immigration is unlikely to go down absent a fairly significant recession. And seeing as it seems that we are in a period of significantly faster than expected global growth, you know, the thing about the, oh, people, you know, Brexit hasn't hurt the economy, it's just like, no, that is clearly untrue if you kind of look at what the global economy is doing and then what you would expect the British economy to be doing. Given what the global economy is doing, Britain is doing considerably worse. But because no one expected the global economy to be doing so well, the kind of Brexit damage is still quite a good economic. It is weirdly analogous to us not joining the common market in the first place. But the important thing about all of that is that immigration is unlikely to go down. However, most of the places where people were really concerned about immigration wasn't that high anyway. So on the one hand, logically, you would assume that in 2022, immigration will not be lower than it is now. And a group of people
Do you really think so? Because I think it probably... I mean, the net immigration figures have fallen quite sharply.
But we are still a net importer of people.
Yeah. I just wonder whether or not it's one of those things that whether or not, I agree there is, for some people there are genuine concerns about, you know, if you're someone that's near a warehouse that kind of exclusively imports kind of groups of, you know, huge groups of Eastern European people en masse, and that there's a kind of resentment about that in the community. But I also think it was notable how much less immigration was on the front pages, right? So I think its salience as an issue is inevitably determined by that. I'm struggling this morning, Stephen, because I'm so angry. I'm so angry about the FT story. Can we talk about the FT story? Because I think it's really interesting when we talk about politics journalism. And actually, our cover story this week, I've written a piece about women in politics. But to be a woman in politics or writing about politics is inevitably to have to negotiate a majority male atmosphere almost all the time. Obviously not in the women's PLP meeting or in, the APPG on childcare or something like that. But even the Women Inequalities Select Committee has got several blokes on it, right? So even that isn't the feminist haven you'd hope. Particularly as one of those is the Conservative Philip Davis, who is opposed to feminism. Actually, I think Gavin Shuker is on that committee as well, I'm pretty sure, who is very pro-feminist. So he will survive the great feminist reaving. I just think it's really fascinating. How aware are you when you are in Westminster of it being a blokey environment?
I mean, hugely aware, not least because it is also a... Yeah, like the one thing that Westminster is even more of than a blokey environment is a white environment, particularly in political journalism, right? Like the parliamentary press gallery is less diverse than the parliamentary parties, who are already not, you know, exactly keeping pace with the country at large. Yeah, so I guess it's kind of something, and I am continually would be the wrong way of putting it, but like every day at some point you kind of bump up against it.
I think it's really fun because it manifests itself in weird little ways. Like one of the things that I think is always really fascinating is that I hardly ever do a show with, say, Isabel Hardman of The Spectator. You know, I think it's kind of on the same level as me in broadcast terms because they don't want to waste two women in the same slot. So you would always kind of, you know, the only time I ever seem to, you know, really do something with another female political journalist is often Women's Hour. Actually, that's not true in the Sunday politics. It's often Isabel Oakeshott as well, because she's a rare female Brexiteer. But it is, I think that is kind of fascinating. And there is a sort of awareness often that there's a kind of extra guilt put on you often for turning things down, because it's be like, but you're the only woman, like, well, we need a woman on the panel. And then, and I think that's kind of its own fascinating guilt trip of like, but you know, if you say no, then we won't have a woman. Like, that's my fault somehow, that I should just give more of my free time away because, you know, there's this huge structural problem. The FT story about this private dinner and all the money that it's raised, you know, I think Nadim Zahawi went to it, right? And he's now saying that actually it's changed a lot and he walked out because he's very uncomfortable. But I just wonder if the whole, but I'm sure there are loads and loads of people in Westminster who, you know, those kind of all-male events actually feel quite natural to them, and therefore Westminster is kind of an extension to that. If anything, they're probably sort of slightly surprised there are quite so many women around the place these days.
I don't know. I think in an odd way that kind of, like, exculpates, like, Nadim Zahawi fighting, like, this amazing dogma ate my homework excuse, right? Because, yes, are the majority of spaces I do my working life in majority white, majority male? Of course. However, none of those spaces have all of the women wearing skimpy black dresses with matching and therefore presumably partially exposed underwear.
I think the idea was that at some point someone might see your underwear. Yeah. So that's why it's got to match, which is grim in itself. The really grim detail from the story was this idea. So for anyone who didn't read it, although it is now free on the FT site, this is this charity fundraising dinner for City Guys, which is all male only, but all of her females, all the staff are female and they're all told to wear matching dresses. And then some of the details were kind of positively Handmaid's Tale-y.
Well, like, not all of the staff, because some of the staff whose job it is to go like, you're
staff.
Not interacting with the,
yeah,
the men enough, or you've been hiding in the toilet for, yeah, a while, go back out and
get poured a bit more, or yeah, kind of have to pretend to like find people's jokes amusing. I mean, God, find a pound for every time I've had to find a man's joke amusing that wasn't amusing. I wouldn't be sitting here, that's what I'm saying.
But yeah, that at least is not a space that is anything close to any space I have been invited to speak at or had to go to or cover, right? So I just kind of feel like I arrived, I left early, or kind of actually like all of these, like, you know, like Peter Jones, who's one of the Dragon's Den thing, is on the guest list. Now, it's not clear if everyone on the guest list actually turned up, you know, but
I arrived and I left early is very much of the kind of, you know, great news of the world 90s all of sort of sex scandals, where it would be like, I made my excuses and left, right, from the kind of swinging party in Hertfordshire. And you always went a bit, did you though? Did you?
I mean, also, right, like, so one of the organisers of this event is a director at the Department of Education, where Nadim Zahawi has just been appointed, yeah, Minister for Children and Families. Now, the reason why I think the, oh, I left early excuse doesn't quite work is, you know, I imagine, you know, let's say that, you know, something dreadful has happened and I've become Minister for Children and Families, and I am at this event and, you know, suddenly, like, you know, a bunch of scantily clad women come out and get poured, and the you know, the compere goes, welcome to the least politically correct event in the social calendar. I feel at that point I might go, oh my God, I need to leave right now before I end up on the front page of something. But I also assume at that point I would tell my Secretary of State at least, look, so I was at this event and one of the directors of our department, the event seems kind of sordid, so maybe we should quietly tell him to quit now. And that I think is kind of part of the problem with the, like, I left early, because it's like, well.
But the other awesome thing about that is that you can see why in that situation people don't want to leave early, because it's embarrassing and they don't want to make a scene, which is such a useful thing. If men are thinking that now, I want them to hold on to that feeling, because that is exactly why women don't speak up about sexual harassment, because you don't want to make a scene, right? If it's something that's really minor but uncomfortable, it's just frank social embarrassment prevents you from going, your hand is on my arse, in a public place, because who wants to draw attention to that? And that's why these things, you know, it is a really useful reminder of how bad things are, you know, good people kind of are complicit in bad things.
Well, I think
social embarrassment is such a strong,
I think that's the thing, a much better argument, as you say, than I left early is, it was a terrible event. I don't know. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah,
I just sat there and waited for it to be over.
And longed for the sweet embrace of death.
Which I think actually, I mean, it's one of those interesting examples, I think, of a lot of, not just political apologies, you know, but there is this weirdness in public life that people do not feel able to do something which in real life people navigate all the time, which is to go, I knew it was wrong, I shouldn't have done it, but I did it anyway.
But I was weak.
Because it just felt so awkward. And you know, yeah. I suspect that actually people are more sympathetic to that argument than they are to going like, oh, you know, When I left, it seemed like such a low-key party.
It was moments after I ended that they started chasing the women out of the toilets because they'd spent too long there not being sleazed over.
But why would I go to a men's only fundraiser? I think that's the thing I like.
Well, this is the thing I find really fascinating. Like, I wouldn't... I'm not really into... I don't know. I'm liberal in the sense of I'm very uneasy about banning things, and I'm not even sure about whether or not I would ban gentlemen's clubs. I certainly, you can't ban private gatherings of people if they want to be all male. But I just find them so weird. I wrote about the Freemasons a couple of weeks ago, and I just thought, I just don't know. It feels so outdated for me that you have to kind of have a work sphere or a leisure sphere that is single sex because you get enough of the little woman at home. That just feels like such a relic of a kind of, you know, the idea that your working man's club or whether it's a gentleman's club is your refuge because all that happens at home is that you get nagged and you need a sort of space to kind of relax and be yourself. Just feels really, really from another time. It's fascinating.
It's just weird to me.
Not least because, you know, most people live in working couples now, right? So it's not this idea that actually you as the guy are the breadwinner and therefore you need this kind of special space where you can relax with your fellow breadwinners.
And also, don't most people have at least one female friend?
Yeah, well, but this has long been my theory of men, is that I'm really deeply suspicious of men who don't have any female friends. And actually, it's a big test of a politician. I'm really fascinated to know, for example, whether or not Boris Johnson has got any female friends. Does he have any women that he's not actively trying to sleep with that he respects as, you know, independent humans? That would be a big test of his character. If I found that he did, actually, that would put him up in my estimation. I'm not entirely sure whether or not that's true. Please write in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today in a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
The question we have is, I think it's a very good one, it's have broadcasters, particularly the BBC, kind of been bounced into taking a tone about Brexit that is more positive than the facts would suggest? This morning on the Today programme, if you didn't have the misfortune to be listening to it, I was listening to Radio 3, but I switched over to hear Tessa Jowell speak about her cancer treatment. There was discussion of this money for the NHS from Brexit and discussion of the Brexit dividend and how it should be spent. Now, like, this is one of those things where, like, you know, you can have your own opinions, but you cannot have your own facts. There is not a Brexit dividend because, one, we can see that the Brexit vote has cost money. But even if it hadn't, right, let's say it had been fiscally neutral, right? There is not a Brexit dividend because the money that is spent on Brexit will mostly go into replicating the things that our joint payment went to, right? The rebate never actually leaves, so that doesn't create more money in the system. The extra money in the system, right, either we will be paying to continue to be a member of the European Members Agency, Medicines Agency, various other kind of cross-border regulatory things, or we will need to hire and create our own quangos, right? But there is not a pool of money that can be... then there's a debate about where you spend it, unless the Conservative Party wants to have a very electorally painful conversation with farmers about where that money is going to go. So it's fictitious, right? Like, there is just not a debate. However, the idea that there might be one was one which was entertained at some length on the Today programme this morning.
It just reminds me a lot of 350 million gate, which I think you wrote about in your cover story about, or maybe it was the Brexit Odd Squad cover story way back when, about the fact that just mentioning it a lot, even in the context of debunking it, put those words together in people's minds. I think it's exactly the same as the war on Christmas, which is, as far as I can see, entirely fabricated out of whole cloth, but American news anchors just said it so much that lots of people believe it's true. Something incredible, like, I can't remember what percentage of US Republicans still think that Barack Obama is a Muslim, right? If you just say things enough, unfortunately, they do stick. So I think that the BBC should not use that phrase itself ever in its reporting and should pick up people when they use it. And just when in the item should always reference the fact that it's bollocks.
But I think also there is this problem, and it's not just one that the broadcasters have, And actually, I see it a lot online, yeah, where people go like, oh, if both sides are slagging you off, you must be doing something right. And it's like, well...
Or you're just wrong in two different ways. Yeah.
Actually, the truth does not exist. There's some, like, weird, like, state of equilibrium between any two random claims. Some claims are false, some claims are true.
I think the problem that the BBC has got, though, is it is so culturally remain, because it is mostly staffed by London-based graduates who are younger than the national average, that it is therefore, I think it goes absolutely over the top in bending over backwards to try and seem what it feels to be fair, even when that's not evidence-based fair, that's just, as you say, equidistance between two points. And that, I think that is a huge problem.
Yeah, and I think... So the fall in the value of the pound, right? That happened because of Brexit. It has been good for manufacturers. It has not been good for households.
Tourists, yeah. It's been good for tourists, but it's been very bad for people who want to go abroad.
Yeah. Right. So there are that's the thing. So like a balancing of what's the impact of the fall of the pound been? Well, it depends on who you are. Whereas a lot of the time it feels balanced becomes some people say the pound has gone up, some people say the pound has gone down.
Mm.
Maybe the pound has stayed the same. The pound has not stayed the same. Harumph, harumph.
Good harumphing.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is licensed under Creative Commons and is Devil by the Devil. If you enjoy the New Statesman podcast, why not take the time to review us on iTunes or SoundCloud or ratemypodcast.org or datemypodcast or any of the numerous podcast rating websites that I'm sure are out there.
I'm angry about men, Stephen. I can't do the podcast while I'm still so angry about men.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.